As a non-commercial educational radio station, KZST supports the free expression of ideas. Please be aware that the opinions expressed are those of the speakers or artists only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the UC Region's KZST staff, management, or underwriters. We welcome your feedback on our programming. Please direct your comments to the Program Review Committee at 831-459-4726 or by email at prc@kzsc.org. Coming up next is going to be a pre-recorded interview with DJ and producer Greg Gillis, also known as Girl Talk. Girl Talk is an artist from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, who has just released a new album with Big Crit and Smoke Dizza and Wiz Khalifa called Full Court Press. Known for his sample-heavy music and his unique mashup albums, Girl Talk will be coming to the Catalyst in Santa Cruz on November 17th.
Well, thanks so much for meeting with me. As I mentioned, I'm a DJ Butterstomp up at KZSC Santa Cruz, the college radio station here, and super excited to be interviewing you and have you on here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, super excited to see you come through Santa Cruz. Have you been through here before?
I've been through the city. I actually don't know if I've ever played. So I think on this tour, I think this might be the only city where I haven't played. There may have been something in there, like, a weird private show here or there, but I don't think so. So I don't think I've ever had a Santa Cruz show.
Where else is that tour taking you in California in the area?
So the tour initially was scheduled for 2020 and that got pushed back till spring of this year. So we kind of already completed like a month of it. And that I think from in California, I think there was just a San Diego and LA show and that was it. And then after that tour, it went well and, I had a really good time. So we decided to add some more dates. So this current run coming up is kind of like the second leg of it. And I think next to Santa Cruz, there's a San Francisco show and I think there's one other California show. But yeah, we were happy to add some dates and kind of keep things going.
Nice. And so you're from Pittsburgh, correct? Are you there now or are you somewhere else on the East Coast?
Yep. So I'm in Pittsburgh now and the first show of kind of the second leg of the tour starts next Thursday. So I'm just, at home doing home stuff and, prepping material for the tour and things like that.
Right on. Have you been there throughout your whole life or have you moved around and lived on in other parts of the country, other parts of the world?
I grew up in Pittsburgh and then I went to college in Cleveland at Case Western University. Oh, cool. And that's when I was in bands and did music and things in high school in Pittsburgh. And that's really where I got my start. And it's kind of part of, kind of the underground scene here in the late 90s. And then when I moved to Cleveland, that's really when I started doing Girl Talk. So a lot of that stuff happened in Cleveland. And I think a lot of people who I like work with creatively, both musically and visuals, all those people are people I met in Cleveland. And then after Cleveland, I was kind of looking for somewhere else to move and get a job. And the first job I landed was back in Pittsburgh, which is, technically, I don't think where I wanted to go at the time. And then once I was there and started working and then Girl Talk stuff kind of took off. And then I was there and I feel like I kind of lucked out. Because I definitely love Pittsburgh and now my roots are kind of firmly planted and I think I'm most likely here for life.
Gotcha. That's home base, huh?
Yes.
Cool. So right before this, talking about, college and moving around and stuff. And I was actually watching a little snippet of the interview you did with Nardwar a while back. And you talked about WRCT, Carnegie Mellon's college radio station, and how that had a big impact on you. And being with KZSC 88.1, I was just curious, did you do college radio when you were in Cleveland? Have you been around the college radio scene? Do you still listen to it a lot?
Yeah, in Pittsburgh it was such a huge part of my life because I think when I was kind of first, and this is maybe 96 97, it was hard to find out about music. The internet was a very different place. It was hard to find out about stuff that wasn't in the mainstream. So I was kind of digging deep and trying to, hear new things. And I stumbled upon WRCT, the Carnegie Mellon station, and it was amazing. And, just a variety of different programming. And my friends and I just got very into listening to it all the time. And we were always blown away that, there were some like shows you could call in and just immediately get on the air or call the DJ and talk to them. That was like mind blowing to a 15-year-old at the time. So that was really cool. And then there's another station in Pittsburgh called WPTS. That's the University of Pittsburgh station. And they were cool too. And my high school band played up there. So it's definitely a kind of a part of the Pittsburgh scene and a fixture here and a big part of my life. And then when I went to Case Western, they have a great station there called WRUW. And I did intern there my freshman year. So I had like a radio show with a friend. And a lot of my friends in college did do radio. I just was kind of decided I was limited on time and was felt like that was kind of taking away from other musical stuff I was doing. But I was kind of actively involved with friends and I definitely loved the station there as well.
What kind of show did you do when you were interning?
So this was 2000. And at that point in time, I feel like kind of a big thing happening was what it's like an embarrassing genre title, but it used to be called IDM, which is like intelligent dance music.
Yeah.
Ridiculous title, but you know, like Aphex Twin, Square Pusher and things like that.
Yeah.
So there was a guy there, I think his name is Joe Banks, and he had a radio show. And then I interned under him and he had like kind of an experimental electronic music show. And then I interned with him and it was cool. And we played all of like the IDM of 2000, which was a very kind of like buzzing thing at that moment.
Nice. So was that kind of where you got your start, like with experimental plunderphonics, electronic stuff with kind of that, that IDM genre, or were you already kind of into the, I don't know, that's kind of scene of music?
Yeah, I was into it a little before that, just in Pittsburgh. I feel like I started going to kind of, you know, underground shows in 96, 97. And a lot of that, I think my intro to electronic music was through, well, definitely through hip hop and rap growing up. But then in addition to that, there was some like bands, like there's a band called Brainiac and a band called Trans Am. And these were rock bands who incorporated electronics. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the first kind of music like that, where I started to be actively interested in synthesizers and electronic elements in music. And then I think as I dove deeper in high school is when I found out about John Oswald and Plunderphonics and all of that. And that really connected to like, I grew up as just loving hip hop and rap. So that was kind of full circle as a kid growing up, listening to Public Enemy and Ice Cube and whatever, Crisscross, everything. And then that kind of connecting to this experimental music and, you know, John Oswald, Negative Land, all of those sort of things. Right. So I think by the time I was in college, I was still interested in that. And that was, I think, kind of my interest was peaking more with that IDM scene, which I was kind of newer to at that time. And then I think some of the early Girl Talk stuff was a combination of those influences, where there was definitely a John Oswald, Negative Land, Plunderphonics influence, obviously with the sample based stuff, but that it was also trying to incorporate kind of IDM-ish elements. I was big into Perfuse 73, was like a big influence, I think, on some of my early records.
Oh, right on. And for listeners out there who don't know what Plunderphonics refers to, it's the way I've kind of interpreted it, and I think the way that John Oswald defined it is taking like pretty much recognizable samples and kind of collaging them together in songs. And I know on some of your songs, especially on like Feed the Animals and Night Rippers, Night Ripper, you've got like 30 plus samples a song. And there's tons of artists who do that. Negative Land, Avalanches are a really cool current version. But yeah, that specific genre really has stood out to me too. And I just wonder, like, how exciting was it for you to be able to take those hip hop backgrounds and all of this interest in new music and be like, oh, I can use this, I can collapse, but I can use this in my creative outlets with music.
Yeah, it was kind of weird growing up listening to hip hop. You didn't think about, or I didn't think about how it was made when I was like 8 years old, you know,
right.
Kind of hearing it. And I just listened to a lot of it back then. So by the time I was kind of a teenager and discovering this other side of things through Plunderphonics, and simultaneously in the late 90s, you had things like, you know, Jay-Z's Hard Knock Life, which is the theme from Annie. So it was kind of a combination of, oh, this is a powerful tool. And the band I was in high school was kind of it was a noise band, but it was very brash and sometimes conceptual, but kind of idiotic at the same time. but, you know, we would just kind of smash TVs and, you know, light off fireworks at the audience and things like that. But we were just very into, you know, anything that was kind of like rule breaking in certain ways. So the idea of of just being able to take someone else's music and just be like, okay, this is part of my music now, was a fun, exciting thing that had roots in what I grew up listening to. But it was just a fun thing at the time. And I definitely, you know, didn't have vision to see the future or intend it to be a career or anything like that. It was just, you know, an interesting element to incorporate into the noise and experimental music we were making. And then I think over time, it kind of fine tuned a little more into like what it became later with kind of like Night Ripper and things like that.
Can't wait to dive into kind of those projects a bit more, but I wanted to first acknowledge that you've got some new projects out. You've got Full Court Press, it's coming out last spring, and then you've got the single with J305, correct?
Yep.
So how does it feel to you to like have dove so far into Plunderphonics and all the sample heavy stuff and then come back after quite some time? It looks like since 2010 with All Day, was that the last project?
There was a I did a project with Freeway in 2014 called Broken okay. Ankles.
Okay, cool. So how does it feel to come back and kind of do more of a collective project with rappers and beat making and producing and kind of switch up your style a little bit? And how exciting is that for you to kind of be able to weave in and out of these different genres that you work with?
Yeah, I mean, I think after All Day, I was kind of figuring out what I would do next. And I had this one-off thing that was part of like an interview where I did a song with Jim Jones from Dipset on the spot. And I went to the studio and it was just fun and different because I'm so used to making everything just by myself in my bedroom and it just kind of like, you know, very meticulous, slow process. It was cool to just be around someone else. And that's someone I you know, was a big fan of, and just watching them create, it was very fun and exciting. So I think that kind of planted the seed to be like, oh, I think I could do something like this. Because on Night Ripper, Feed the Animals, All Day, a big foundation of those albums was hip hop and rap. And that's a lot of stuff I grew up listening to. So to me, those albums were almost just like imaginarily producing for these artists. Like I'm more or less making beats out of samples. So I was like, there's no reason I can't just make beats. I am making them. You know, that's basically what these albums are. So I think the first one was Freeway in 2014. And that was a great artist to kind of first connect with just because he's very open-minded and was great to work with just in terms of, you know, he'd kind of jump on any beat because certain artists I deal with, some people want something very specific and don't want to get outside of, you know, their vision for what they're doing. Other people are kind of more open-minded. And Freeway was down to experiment and do different stuff. And I think that project, Broken Ankles, I'm very proud of it and I love it, but it did turn out different than I intended. I kind of intended it to sound more like, you know, one of my kind of mashup albums. But it's kind of like you can't force it if it's not going there. I felt like the songs just were doing better, kind of living on their own, breathing a little more. We didn't have to have, you know, five beat changes in 2 minutes or anything like that. So, but that kind of started that, and I just kind of kept working, and I never wanted anything to be stale, and I never wanted it to, you know, with Night Ripper and things like that, I didn't want it to be like, you know, okay, now I'm on Night Ripper version 44, and right, now that's all mashups, volume 86. I kind of just didn't intend it to be that way. And, you know, as you know, and kind of with the background, there are albums before Night Ripper that were sample based that weren't necessarily as mashup driven. So I was excited to kind of keep moving forward under the umbrella of sample based music, but just, you know, continue to evolve. So that's kind of been occupying, you know, my years since then, and then just kind of getting in the studio with different people. And it's been cool and definitely has, you know, challenged me in certain ways. And I think with Full Court Press, the new one with Wiz Khalifa, Big Crit, and Smoke Dizza, you know, that is almost entirely sample based. I think every song has samples on it other than one. So again, I feel like that's a cool extension of, you know, what I've been doing. The guy who mastered the album, Frank Musara, is a guy who used to have a project called Hearts of Darknesses, and I toured with in the early 2000s. And he also did experimental electronic music. And as we were kind of working on the album together, we kind of took a step back, and he was just saying, this is kind of amazing and funny that this is like where you're at right now, just, you know, fully producing a rap album for these guys, but it's all sample based. And I do feel like it's a, you know, I think for some of my people who follow what I do, you know, there's a certain contingent who want, you know, more albums like All Day, and I get that. And everyone has that experience with artists where you have a sound that you like of them. If they move on, you want them to stick to that thing. But yeah, I'm really kind of proud of where it's at. And at this point, it's funny because I feel like there's kind of different audiences for that different music. And there's some people who like all of it, but there's some people who at this point only know me for the production. And there's some people who only know me for the shows. And, you know, it's a cool thing to me to be able to tour and play show. And when I play live, it's kind of a little bit more oriented towards stuff that sounds like Feed the Animals and those albums. So it's cool for me to be able to like still do that material and have an audience for that, but also be able to do sample based production and have an audience for that as well.
Right. And that's, that's so cool because it's like, you know, who wants to do one thing their whole life? It's really exciting to be able to explore different genres and different types of music, and I'm sure collaborating must be so fun. With that group of Smoke Dizza, Wiz Khalifa, and Big Crit, had you guys been planning on this for a while? Are these like friends of yours? How did you guys link up?
Yeah, I've known Wiz since I think 2005-ish. And when I made Night Ripper, that's, you know, when before things kind of took off for me, I had a bunch of copies burned onto CDR and I mailed them out to a bunch of people like DJs or magazines, and I would carry them with me and give them to people just trying to like get it out there before it was officially released. And at that time, I remember hearing a Wiz Khalifa song on the radio in Pittsburgh and being into it, kind of looking into him and started following what he's doing a bit. And he was playing a show that was a few blocks from like one of my best friend's house in Pittsburgh. So we decided to go. And at this show, there was probably like 50 people there, you know, just kind of small underground sort of thing. And he played and it was cool. And then afterwards, I like introduced myself and I gave him a copy of Night Ripper on CDR. That was like the first time we met, which is funny. We've talked about since then and we were talking about, I think he kind of like remembers that moment. I don't think he ever listened to it, but that was our first connection. And then for me, I think things kind of took off a little bit before they did for him. Like he really had some success at that time, but he really blew up in 2010. With Black and Yellow. Right. So between 2006 and 2010, there was a handful of times where I had shows and I had him on. So he like played with me in Pittsburgh and in Brooklyn one time. And one time I curated a show at the Andy Warhol Museum and I had him play it. So we were cool through that. And then when his stuff took off, you know, we stayed in contact and it turned into a relationship where I would run into him, you know, once or twice a year at a festival or in the airport. And I always felt like he really kind of respected and appreciated that I, you know, was, you know, kind of supported him to some degree. You know, I don't think I had any role in his success at all. But in the early days before his stuff took off, the fact that I had him on some shows in Pittsburgh and things like that, I think he always appreciated that. So because of that, we just stayed cool and I kind of knew his management and his friends and everything. And then after the Freeway project in 2015 or 16, I ran into his manager at a Dej Loaf show in Pittsburgh and we were talking and he kind of threw out the idea of me and Wiz doing a project together. And that was kind of the first time that idea was bubbling, even though we've known each other for a long time. And then I think the first time we got in the studio was 2017. And at that time, I started to work with Big Crit and Smoke Dizza around a similar time. And initially I was just trying to do a project with any individual artist. And I kind of get in the studio with people and sometimes it doesn't go well. And that's the end of that relationship. Other times, you know, you might, you know, get in the studio for a couple of days and kind of build on that. So with each of these guys, I was making music and the plan was to do an individual project, ideally with all of them. And then at a certain point I got, Wiz on a Big Crit song and I got Crit on a Dizza song and separate sessions to knock them together. And I was kind of at home listening to it and I liked the way it was working together. And kind of like with my albums All Day and Feed the Animals, those albums for me are a lot about just trimming the fat, you know, accumulating so much music and ideas and just really trying to slice out anything that's unnecessary that I'm not 100% into. So kind of listening through all the material I recorded with Wiz, Crit, and Dizza, I was like, this would kind of be cool if it was just all of them together. And it was just kind of like, you know, a combination album with all of us. So I proposed that idea and I threw it out there to them, honestly, not thinking it would stick just because it's complicated with them with different management labels and everything like that. And they were all into it and they all have their own history together and they all kind of came out at a similar time. So we ended up going to LA and all get together for a few days in the studio, and that's where kind of the heart of the project really kind of came together.
Wow, that's an awesome kind of story. I love hearing how it was a little bit disjointed, and then you kind of had that moment of realizing that you didn't have to make an individual project with each, but actually it kind of, it had there was a middle ground that you could find with that. And I love the project, and I like how it is sample heavy, but in a much more subtle way maybe than some of your earlier stuff. But that doesn't mean that it can't be sample heavy. And I think you're kind of digging into those more of those hip hop roots there, of like making those samples a kind of a base for something to be done over it, which instead of kind of putting it at the focal point, which I really appreciate. But yeah, no, it's exciting to kind of see where your music has jumped around. So kind of going back to your earlier roots a little bit, and some questions that I've been dying to ask you about, being such a big fan of, you know, your whole discography, but specifically Feed the Animals and Night Ripper. Those albums have always stood out to me a lot. I used to do a radio show on KZSC where I'd play song, and this was right when I was kind of getting into Plunderphonics and sampling, and I'd play a pair of songs and like, or songs in groups of three or fours, and I'd play the sample or the samples that show up in different songs, and then I'd do like sample chains. So I'd have like one or two samples, and then I'd show, or I'd play the song that those samples show up in, essentially. And being able to do that for you was the funnest thing to do on air. And I didn't know about you until my brother told me about it, because I was telling my brother, I was like, yeah, I'm doing this sample show. And he's like, well, do you know about Girl Talk? And I was like, no, I don't. He's like, you can't do a sample show without Girl Talk. And I was like, and I started listening, and like, I just got so into it. And I'll never forget the time that I got to go on air and play Apple Bottom Jeans Sunday Morning and then Hands in the Air by you. That was pretty fun. I think somebody texted in, they're like, what is going on?
Thank you, I appreciate that.
Yeah, so that was a lot of fun for me, and I was able to kind of like come back to that a lot through the show, come back to your stuff. I did, I think, two or three quarters of that show up at the station. Spent a lot of time with your music, and like I said, with the Avalanches, that's another big one for me. But that led to me spending a lot of time on Who Sampled, the website. You ever check that out?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So I'd always be looking through your stuff and seeing how you've got, you know, 30 samples in a song or whatever. And I'm curious if you by any chance know the most amount of samples you squeezed into one of those songs when you're kind of at that heyday of Feed the Animals and Night Ripper and All Day.
I no idea, actually. It's funny because I think with those albums, I really, you know, composed them as one song. So it's never like, here's this song. It was kind of like building it as one thing. And I think with Night Ripper, I can't remember Feed the Animals, I kind of built it in maybe like a couple different chunks. So it's like I started at certain tempos and then I like connected those pieces together, kind of exactly the way you would do a puzzle, you know, having a couple different things working at once. I can't remember, you know what I mean? It was always, you know, I think is something interesting. It's like with a lot of the production I'll do with like something like Full Court Press, you know, a lot of times with the drums, what works best is kind of simple, basic sounds over top of a sample. I think on those albums, it was always an effort to incorporate a lot of real subtle things, samples, you know, just like a tambourine, you know, just the percussion pieces could be layers of different samples, which gives it a lot of character. And, you know, it was never an effort, obviously, to just do sheer numbers, like, but sometimes it's like, oh, you know, using these weird percussions from this Diana Ross song sounds so good in this subtle way under here. So that was something I was always really proud of, that on all of those songs. I think sometimes when you hear certain mashups or remixes, you know, you might hear a couple songs together and that can be amazing sometimes. But I just love kind of making it dense where you kind of get lost in it. And I wanted to take its own form is always the goal, you know, for it to be transformative. And sometimes when you can just recognize everything, you know, you might just be able to piece it apart in your mind. I want it to be so, you know, kind of dense that you kind of get lost in it and it turns into its own thing. And there's no formula for that, but it's something you kind of hear when it happens, where it's like that light bulb moment of being like, oh, this is, somewhere else now. You know, I have heard these songs a million times, and now they are somewhere else. And, you know, it's funny because I, you know, love everything I sample and I'm proud of my work, but in certain ways, it's like I've permanently altered the songs forever to me. It's like I, when they come on the radio, they sound slow to me, or I hear like my parts missing from them. Because it's, I think when you're working in that way where it's additive and you're combining things, sometimes when you hear one element, it sounds kind of like it's missing those other things.
Totally.
So it's like permanently. There's certain ones that not as much, but certain ones I'm like can't hear it the same way ever again.
That's really interesting. And I actually can kind of relate to that in some ways to your music, because there are certain songs that I heard for the first time in your work that I had never heard until I went on Who Sampled and tracked them down and then listened to them separately. But they'll always originally for me come from your music. For some reason I had never heard Ready on the Floor by Hot Chip or Ready for the Floor. And like, I like that song independently now, but I forget how you mashed that up, but it's kind of like you totally changed that song when you used it. And so like, I'll always have that connection first. And I think that's really quite amazing with your work, especially because you do isolate things. Like I'll look through the Who Sampled page and not even have had any idea that you had, you know, whatever Jay-Z song in there, because you just took the beat or you just took a little bit of the vocals. It really becomes its own thing and its own art form, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, thank you. And I haven't, like, I use Who Sampled all the time. I haven't dissected my own stuff on there, but I'm assuming, like, even at this point, I couldn't tell you every sample on those records. You know, I mean, I can definitely recognize the clear things, but back then there's so many subtle things, like literally adding this hand clap sounds great to me, but it's like, you know, 10 years later, I could not tell you where that hand clap came from. Certain ones you can't, you know, this is so distinctive. This is the best snare sound because it's from whatever. Other things, you know, when you're just dealing with hundreds of samples, certain things get kind of lost.
Totally. And I think what I was kind of thinking about, what I've always appreciated about kind of your work from those projects is how it's like, when it is recognizable, it's kind of humorous in this way. And I think it, like, it's humorous and it's also impressive. And I love the way, like, for instance, like I know on one that I wrote down was like In Step off of Feed the Animals, you have Groove Is in the Heart over Lithium by Nirvana and Push It by Salt and Pepper, which is just like, it's such a rare kind of, those are three songs I would have never thought could have fit together, but they do. Do you kind of get a chuckle out of making mashups like that? And do you?
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I think it's kind of like with, I think anything, like even in a movie or making a comedy, there's like a right tone to hit, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And you can go a little too far one way or another. So I think there's something lighthearted and fun and funny. And I think at that time, it's so far removed now because it's like 15 years later. But I think with Night Ripper at that time, for me, as someone who came up in the underground, you know, there's kind of the cliche back then was kind of this pretentious attitude of kind of rejecting anything that wasn't independent music and hating anything that was mainstream and all of those things. So I think those albums were reacting against that in certain ways and really trying to embrace a lot of different things, saying that like underground music is interesting and cool, but also mainstream music has its value too. And all these things should be, you know, accepted in different ways. So with that music, I didn't want it to be too ironic or anything like that. I always wanted to be sincere. And this is just my personal tone. You know, I think in various mashup and remix people, they have their own tone in how they're doing it. Some people, and I think my early work, the tone was a little different than Night Ripper. I think I kind of found my voice a little more. But I think with all of that stuff, I like it to be fun and funny and humorous, but also like I never want to poke fun at anything. Like,
right.
That's definitely not the point. It's supposed to be hit this little sweet spot where it's an open embrace of all of this stuff. And I'm definitely a fan and trying to, you know, not poke fun at it, any of it, but it's the fun and funny or humor is in, you know, the combination or the similarities or seeing these worlds together and all of those things. So, but yeah, I think that's a subtle thing to me that sometimes I will hear other people's work and it's like, oh, they have kind of a different attitude or tone towards this based on how they're doing this than I do. And not that theirs is right or wrong. It's just different than like my, how I'm, what I'm trying to say. And, you know, now I think, you know, 15 years removed from that in 2022, when things are just drastically different, it's hard to even, you know, explain that, I think, to a younger person. It's like, you know, in this day and age, it's like everyone is in mainstream music, was widely acceptable and I think, you know, well respected critically and things like that. Whereas back then, it wasn't necessarily like that. There's more walls up. So I think part of the battle for me was being like, all of this stuff is cool to me. And if you're not into it, I don't care. I'm going to throw it all together and make something interesting out of it.
Right. And I think your work really shows that too. And I'll try to get a couple snippets on this for listeners when I edit it. But I think you really do walk that line of like, there is a certain level of humor to the different worlds you're bringing together, but it also is very like intentional. And it's very clear that you like love this music and you think about this music and you think about the ways that it can flow together. And for me, it's like, I'll hear some of the mashups that I'll chuckle at, but then there's ones that it's like, it gives me, like, I also DJ and I also mix stuff, and it gives me a huge rush to hear certain ones, like little euphoric bits that come through. There's one mashup you have of These Eyes by the Guess Who and Real Love by Mary J. Blige on Set It Off. Went through and up, we made it through the storm. I really want you to realize, I really want to put you on. I've been searching for someone to satisfy my every need. Won't you be my inspiration? Be the real love that I need. I'm real love. I'm searching for a real love. Someone set my heart free. Real love. I would have never like put those two together, but it just works in like the most beautiful way. And there's tons of those throughout the album where you'll like kind of get, you know, like kind of farther away from each other songs that work together. And then you'll get these ones that just click. And it's so amazing to hear that. And I just kind of wonder, is it all trial and error when you put that together? Is it like just bringing this mass amount of music together? Or do you have things in your head where you're like, yeah, that would really work with that, or that would really work with that?
I think it is mainly trial and error. I think it was more so back then. I think over the years, I've kind of fine-tuned it a little more. I think my, like, it just, I think I have more of a catalog in my head. And I think I, you know, honestly, like, understand music a little better now than I used to. So now I do think, when, because I'm always making new stuff for shows and things like that, I think there is some more intuitive things to me now where it's like, oh, some ideas come in my head rather than playing through them. But back then, it was an effort of sitting down, and it was a labor of love where you're just sitting for hours on end, just going through like hundreds of combinations, and just it's this like weird, it feels like gambling a little bit, where it's like you're trying to get that one, you're trying to get your win in there, catching the wave.
Yeah.
And it's like you find a couple that are good, but it's like, oh, I don't know, there could be something better. Why don't we listen to 300 more samples through this, you know? So to this day, I have a hard time, like, I don't want to miss it, you know?
Right.
So I think that's why those albums are like that. And, you know, it's just a trial and error. And then these are the ones that click to me for whatever reason. Sometimes it's even, you know, not perfect musically, but the vibe was right or whatever. So yeah, it's that was kind of the process. But yeah, these days I do think I kind of hear things a little bit more technically now, where it's like, you know, here's this song when I'm making something now, it's like, oh, this song's in this key, so here are these. And I even think, like, on a very nerdy level, just like my cataloging is more thorough now, of just being like, oh, here's what the tempo, and here I can look through these vowels or whatever. So yeah, but yeah, it still is trial and error. But I think it's a little more fine-tuned today for me.
And I'm sure in somewhere in your mind palace, you kind of have like certain beats or songs that have stuck. Well, you'll come to something and you'll be like, oh yeah, maybe I can bring that back, or I can use that, or I don't know.
Yeah, it's like, you know, there's some issues to this too, because I feel like certain things are like your crutches you go to all the
Right.
time, you know. But I definitely have a little catalog in my mind, and you know, especially with shows, because shows are a slightly different thing for me than those albums, where it's like I want it to translate live, which is like a different energy. So I think it connects to the style of Feed the Animals and All Day and Night Ripper. But there's certain things that I love on those albums that maybe are just kind of low key for a show, and that works really great on an album, but maybe doesn't translate as well live. So I do feel like I have a separate kind of like catalog in my mind for here's kind of go to things that I can mess with live. But I always love that changes over time. You know, certain things like didn't hit in certain ways back then that like I'm able to do now, or you know, things I could do production wise to kind of make it a little more hype that I maybe wasn't able to do back then.
Totally. Yeah, I'm really excited to see it when you come to the Catalyst. So I kind of wanted to hear a little bit about the Illegal Art record label that you used to work with. You have most of your previous albums, such as Night Ripper, Feed the Animals, I think a few others. I think you have. Do you have Secret Diary on there too, or?
Yeah, everything I've released has been with them outside of the recent one. The
Okay.
literally the stuff I've put out in the past year or so. So yeah, I mean, I sent I think in like 2000, 2001 when I was making my first stuff, I started sending stuff out to some labels, and there's just a, really just a handful of labels that I knew of who, you know, released material that was you know, potentially in a gray area with copyright and sample-based music. Tiger Beat 6, Kid 606's label, which I was a huge fan of, they did it. There's a label called VVM I was a big fan of. There's a guy named Evolution Control Committee out of Columbus, Ohio, who had a label, and Illegal Art, who I mainly knew in the late 90s. They released a compilation called Deconstructing Beck, and it was all unsolicited Beck remixes. And you know, it's like people like John Oswald and Negative Land had dabbled in stuff like that at the time, but it was pretty, you know, I guess slightly aggressive in just the title and them putting it out there. So it kind of got to be known. I think it maybe was even mentioned on MTV News at the time, because I think there was a potential copyright issue about it and all this stuff. So that's, I think, how I initially heard about them. And yeah, they got back to me and were interested, the main guy, Philo. You know, I've kind of continued to send him demos, and he agreed to put out my first album in 2002. And then after that, he put out every other release of mine up until All Day in 2010. And yeah, it was an amazing experience with him, just because he had was running such a small boutique label. And you know, when things took off for me with Night Ripper, you know, I had never experienced anything like that, and I don't think he had either. So it was nice to have someone to go through that with who was kind of on the same page.
And are most of the artists, I know that Illegal Art has kind of in their bio, like pushing the boundaries of sample-based music. Are most of their artists on Illegal Art? I see the Brand Flakes, Okapi, People Like Us, Steinsky, a few of the names that come up on the main page. Are they all mostly like Plunderphonic, sample-based DJs, experimental artists? What kind of music is Illegal Art really comprised of?
Yeah, it's all sample-based stuff, but a really wide variety. So I think, you know, I would say my stuff is probably leaning towards the most accessible. A lot of the other stuff is very far out, and you know, some of it you might not even recognize it as sample-based since it's so kind of far removed and processed. But yeah, just a lot of cool stuff, and you know, over the years it kind of changed. And Steinsky is a guy who's kind of a pioneer in the 80s doing like there's a whole story behind him. So the stuff they put out with him was kind of like a retrospective of some of his work, as some like pioneering kind of Plunderphonic stuff. So yeah, so I felt like I kind of fit in well with my first release. It was kind of, you know, it wasn't necessarily similar, but I think a similar level of accessibility in that it wasn't accessible at all, you know. And then I think when things kind of for me grew to be more, you know, something that would be potentially reach a wider audience. You know, I felt kind of, you know, just I was happy that, you know, there was a time when I was sending my stuff out, maybe trying to even after I initially put stuff out, but there's never an official contract. There's always handshake agreements. And, you know, it's just very underground DIY sort of approach to everything. So there was a moment later on where I was potentially trying to get maybe put my stuff out on a different label to reach a wider audience. And in retrospect, I'm really happy that that didn't happen, just because I've loved working with Philo over the years. And, you know, I always just feel like we see eye to eye, and I've never butted heads, and there's never been any issues where with another label, I have no idea. You know, I have no experience. But some of those other labels, not even the ones I mentioned, but other people who would potentially put out something sample based, are more of a traditional business, whereas I think Illegal Art was more of a, you know, kind of a boutique project. You know, it wasn't something where I don't think anyone was trying to necessarily make a living off of it.
Totally. There's some really cool looking stuff on here. I'm just kind of scrolling through right now. A Mutated Christmas. I see the Deconstructing Beck thing. It says coming soon. There's some really cool looking projects that I'm excited to check out.
One of the later ones they put out was a band called Junk Culture, who I toured with, and their stuff is really good. So definitely check that out. And that was kind of more of a late 2000s approach to sample based stuff, where it was a little bit more, you know, there's like more of a sort of indie approach to it, or something that was maybe closer to even the Avalanches or something like that. So, but they were really good, and I thought they were cool live too, because they had a live drummer along with like doing electronics and samples and things like that. So I thought they were cool, and I loved playing shows with them.
That is really cool. I like the aspect of bringing some live music into it too, kind of making it a multimedium like that.
It felt, you know, with that era, with like things like chill wave and things that were happening like that, there was a lot of stuff that was just kind of like everything in a cool way just starts to, you know, walls start breaking down. So it's like all of a sudden there's bands that are using samples casually. It's not a big, you don't have to be, that doesn't have to be your whole identity. You can be singing and making pop music, but have a sample here or there. So I think, you know, I feel like when I started, it was very kind of clear cut, either you're doing samples or you weren't. Whereas I think over the years, it's just kind of become more part of just the language of music in 2022, where it's like any given song might have a drum break in, or might have an electronic element. All of those things really broke down, where it used to be, you know, there used to be these distinct divisions between whether you're making electronic music or you're in a band, or of course, there's always groups that kind of blended those things together. But I felt like there weren't as many then, whereas now, you know, everything blends. Everyone's making music on a computer to some degree.
Totally. And a big part of the ethos, it seems, of Illegal Art record label is accessibility. You know, you can literally just look it up, go to the website, click on your preferred artist, and go to their records. And not only that, it's you can download MP3s for free, or you can pay $5 or $10. Was that something that Philo and this record label kind of pushed from the beginning, making it accessible to the public, or is that something that kind of developed over time?
Yeah, you know, like I was saying, I think when you hear those early records, they're so, you know, difficult to listen to. It's like you're just never expecting it to be a big deal. So right. Reaching any audience is great, and you're not necessarily like expecting to be even paid for it or make a living. I can't speak for anyone else, but that's just kind of where I came from, especially with my background prior to doing Girl Talk and my high school noise band, all of that. You just didn't, you know, you were going to make stuff and there might find a little audience, but there's never anything that was going to be some career or anything like that. I don't know if that's the same for other people in the label or Filer. I can't necessarily speak from it. That's how it always felt to me. Just getting it out to any audience is the goal, not necessarily like, you know, like selling a $10 CD or something like that. But in 2007, when Radiohead put out In Rainbows, I don't know or think they were the first people to do this, but it was one of the first big cases where they did the pay for what you want model. And when that happened, that just seemed perfect for what we were doing. So I think that happened, you know, within a year of when we were going to put out Feed the Animals, and it just seemed like, oh, we definitely should do this. I love, you know, and this is what kind of everyone does now. It's just what they used to call a surprise release. It was kind of like, I don't need to, you know, we don't need some big press build up to this or anything like that. Why don't we just drop it and have everyone hear it the same day that critics get to hear it, and get it out to as many people as possible, make it basically free. And that just, you know, that didn't even seem like some radical idea. That just seemed like the best idea. Like, let's just, this is the best way to get it out to the largest audience. And that'd be cool. And that day, I think out of all my albums, I always remember the day Feed the Animals came out, just because it was the first time I had put something out where there was like anticipation and hype behind it. And Like I was living in a really efficiency apartment in Pittsburgh, and MTV News came to Pittsburgh to like interview me before it came out in this apartment. And it just seemed like there was just this like hype, and it was crazy. And I remember kind of like staying up all night. And it was basically like, when we upload it, it's just going to be there. We're going to, you know, on our MySpace page or whatever, say it's available. And it just seems so cool to just immediately reach the people and do the, you know, the quote surprise release and have it so people could hear it immediately. And you didn't have to wait for the CD or anything. And it just made a lot of sense, and it was cool and effective. And that seems, you know, kind of the world's so different now. It's completely different in certain ways, but there's certain elements of that still stick, or it's like a lot of bigger artists do, you know, the releases where they announce it 1 week before it comes out. Uh-huh. And of course, streaming services that most people are on, it's like, you know, everyone can hear it immediately. All of those things that was kind of novel at the time is kind of the norm now.
Yeah, absolutely. And so just to clarify, when it first dropped, was this the only place it was accessible via this website or whatever iteration it was back then?
Yes. So we had CDs. You could buy a CD from the website, or they may have been in stores. I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure it was just that site. And I am also pretty sure it crashed. But we like did our best to like, and I remember there was a lot of preparation. I don't do web design or anything like that, but there was a lot of talks of just how to make this like so it wasn't going to crash. And then it did crash. But yeah, it was like you could just, you know, just go to that site, which was amazing. That was such a cool moment in time where it was like kind of still people are still buying CDs, but it's almost basically past the CD era. And it was pre the streaming era. It was like this little nugget in time where basically you could just say, here's a website. And then the whole world could, you know, if there was enough hype or excitement behind that album, they could all go to that website and download it. That was such a cool era. And that also leveled the playing fields in terms of like, if you're doing something sample based, that in this day and age might not be, you know, you might not be able to put that on Spotify or one of these big company websites. Back then it was like you could. So it's like we, you know, obviously Radiohead was a significantly bigger band than Girl Talk, but it's like they also did a website. We had a website. There's no like centralized place to get things. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the unfortunate thing about now. It's just all, you know, it's basically like if it doesn't exist on Spotify to a lot of people, it just doesn't exist. Which I understand, you know what I mean? That's just kind of it's just the simplicity of it and the ease of it. But back then, yeah, it was just it was on a blog, on a website, anything like that. That was it. It was officially released.
Wow, that's really interesting to hear. I think I've sort of been learning too about trying to further my reaches outside of just streaming and digging a lot through physical music, but also kind of digging more through SoundCloud and Bandcamp and kind of, you know, still streaming services, but there's a lot of stuff there that's not on Spotify, and there's stuff on Spotify that's not there. And there's just so much music out there to be found that I feel like people don't always acknowledge nowadays.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I do love, Bandcamp and SoundCloud, and those alternatives are amazing. And that's really cool. And I wish that was more widespread, that just acknowledged that you don't necessarily, I think sometimes it's just like with people's home stereo systems, it's just connected to their Spotify, and just literally just like the programming or the simplicity of that kind of like for the bulk of people, that's all that they have and that's their music. But it'd be nice if you know, those other, you know, platforms and outlets were acknowledged as equal. But it is cool too. It does seem like there's lots of, like you're saying, a lot of stuff on Bandcamp that doesn't exist on Spotify and things like that. I feel like that's the way it should be. There should be a variety of different places and different, you know, not everything has to be everywhere.
And YouTube too. I mean, that's been a game changer for me with DJing too, and just looking for stuff that's not, you know, that has very little plays or isn't super known. And like, you can dive so deep on that, which I really appreciate. And I hope more people kind of, as Spotify algorithms maybe start to get a little bit played out, more people start to go back into digging for music a little bit more.
Yeah, I'll be curious. I feel like, you know, there's going to be some, you know, it's like every era, it's like everyone's so convinced that this is the way it's going to be forever, you know, and you know, it will be over soon, and it will be on to the next thing. You know, and then everyone will be complaining that we wish we could be back to the Spotify era. But that's kind of how it goes. But yeah, it seems like at the time, it's hard to imagine. It's just so dominant that it could change, but it always does. But yeah, to your original point too, I love listening. YouTube's an amazing source of stuff, just for listening to things and samples and all of that. Like, it's a great resource.
Totally. And so just to hop back really quick to the illegal art stuff. So, you know, you're a pretty well-known artist now. Why do you keep all your stuff up there for free? Like, is that, I'm sure, I mean, obviously there's obvious answers, but why is that important to you?
Yeah, I mean, kind of like I was saying before, it's like I get the ease and simplicity of these streaming sites, and that to some people, if they're not on there, it doesn't exist. But I would like to, you know, keep it alive elsewhere in case you're not into those things. You know what I mean? Right. I don't think we don't have to do that. And there's certain, you know, it's like with My Album All Day, that's not on streaming services.
Right. So yeah, I looked for that and I saw that was only on the website and on YouTube.
Yeah, we kind of made a decision back then that was the one where we weren't going to put it onto CD, and that one was just going to exist up there. And then we have kind of stuck with that. And, you know, my most common tweet at me is probably, why isn't All Day on Spotify? Like, that's something I hear every day, and I get it, but it's kind of like, it's out there. You can get it. Right. You know? Yeah, it's great to still have elements of that there. But I also, you know, I get it. I also am a functional music listener. So times change and, you know, there's something to the simplicity of the tools available right now.
Totally. And I think too, it's awesome because it pushes, as we're kind of, you know, saying here, it pushes listeners to go check out illegal art and go check out these sites and go outside of just the very structured system of streaming.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, but it would be cool to me. And that's just the internet in general. You know, it's like everything is getting so centralized to these, you know, specific places where you're almost not used to go to websites. You know what I mean? And people would make it. And I'm sure there's, you know, I'm sure there's a scene of that I don't know about. You know what I mean? More on their own stuff. But maybe in the future, there will be some sort of reaction where it's like, you know, that would be cool for, you know, a larger artist or something to, you know, you can only get it from this alternative source. I mean, some people do that, but then it's like, it's just such a numbers game these days. And it seems like if you're not playing it, you're losing, you know what I mean? And everyone's just checking your stats constantly on social media and Spotify. And it's just, everyone's like in that game. And it doesn't seem like there's too many people who are actively, you know, fighting against that anyway. It's just like the game is so dominant and, to everything, you know, to non-musicians too, to just everything, social media likes and all of that. So I get it. Everyone's kind of sucked up in it, but it's like, it's nice to have some alternatives, and it doesn't always have to be, you don't have to play by those rules. You can do whatever you want and upload your music wherever, or it can be small. And there's nothing wrong with having a smaller fan base or, you know, a cult following or whatever. If it's not reaching full audiences, it's not always the worst thing in the world, depending on what you're going for.
Absolutely. And I really hope that stays alive here. Well, I have to thank you so, so much for this interview, Girl Talk. This has been really amazing to kind of geek out with you about your own music and kind of how you see music as a whole. And I'm really excited to see you come to Santa Cruz. So it's November 17th. Is that correct?
I don't know, but that sounds right. And, okay. Yeah, I'm looking for the show's been the tour's been amazing this year. So I'm really kind of proud of the show, and it's night to night. It's like things change, but in general, it's like the set to me feels like a retrospective set of old stuff and brand new stuff, everything. So yeah, it's been really cool to get back out on the road after, you know, pandemic times and all of that. So yeah, should be a fun show.
And are you playing solo for most of these, or you have an opener? Are you collaborating?
Yeah, we have, we're having an opener. I can't remember who it is. We have someone locked in, I think, for Santa Cruz and for this run, for the previous run, I was touring with an artist named Hugh Augustine, a friend of mine and an artist I'm a big fan of. But for this run, I think we're mainly doing kind of local and regional people in each show. So I can't remember who's playing the Santa Cruz show yet. But yeah, should be a fun night.
Right on. Well, this has been a KZSC interview with DJ Futterstomp and the one and only Girl Talk.
Yeah, is it KZSC?
KZSC 88.1.
That's actually a hard call letters. What's up? This is Greg Gillis, aka Girl Talk. You're listening to 88.1 KZSC.
Perfect. Woo!